So take a few minutes to recall the motivation you generated at the start of the day and may have regenerated several times during the day to ensure that what we're doing here tonight will be of the greatest possible benefit to ourselves, to others, and to the world. Okay, so we have been going through this topic called the seven kinds of awarenesses. These are seven different types of minds or consciousnesses that we all have at different times, and knowing about them is beneficial for our Dharma practice, because what we're trying to do is transform our mind, decrease, and then eventually get rid of the aspects of mind or types of mind that are problematic, that lead to more suffering and confusion for ourselves and others and keep us unenlightened, unawakened. We're trying to get rid of those, and we're trying to develop states of mind that are correct and positive and beneficial, and will help us be free of suffering, reach enlightenment, and help others reach enlightenment as well. So knowing more about the mind and the different types of mind is very helpful. In fact, it's really essential if we want to do this work. And so of the seven types of awareness, we've only covered the first two, the first one being direct perceivers. And those are all non-conceptual states of mind. We have those all the time: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, bodily sensations, and so forth. But there are also types of direct perceivers that are crucial for spiritual development, in particular yogic direct perceivers, which, for example, the direct realization of emptiness, direct realization of impermanence, and so on. So those are mental direct perceivers rather than sensory ones. There's different kinds of direct perceivers. And then the second of the seven types of awareness is called inferential cognizers. And those are only conceptual states of mind. Direct perceivers experience their objects directly in a kind of naked, direct way, without the medium of a mental image. But conceptual states of mind don't get at their object in a direct way. Instead, they do so through this, what's called a meaning generality, a mental image of the object. So they're less ideal than the direct perceivers, but they're still crucial because, for example, to realize emptiness, selflessness, impermanence, we can't just immediately perceive them with our senses. We have to first get an inferential or conceptual understanding of those. Then gradually that can transform into a direct perception. So these are also very, very important for our practice. And we looked at three types of inferential cognizers. And last week we got up to the second one, and then we got a little stuck discussing it and trying to figure it out. Yeah. So anyway, the first of the three types of inferential cognizers is called inference through the power of the fact. And that's the main one that's needed to realize these important topics like subtle impermanence, selflessness, and emptiness, and so forth. So that's really the most important of the three. The second one is called inference through renown, and that's said to realize terminological suitability. So when we, on Katina Day, Stephen was here, and he told me about this book. He had given a copy of it to the Srivasti Abbey Library. Has anyone read it? It's called Reducing Suffering, yeah? And it's written by Geshe Ngawang Pende. He lives in Atlanta? Has he been here?
Not yet.
Not yet? Yeah. Anyway, so he wrote this book. It's a Lowrig book. It's about these seven kinds of awareness, but in a much more kind of accessible, practical way. I haven't had a chance to read much of it. But anyway, and here he has a bit more explanation of this second type of inference that we were puzzling over last week. So I'll just read what he says. Okay, so we called it inference through renown. He calls it a renowned correct sign. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And he says, it deals with the nominal designations of phenomena, which are called such and such through being merely worldly renowned. With this kind of inferential cognizer, its object is something that is merely nominally renowned as being the case. This includes phenomena for which we have absolutely no basis for accepting it to be the case other than the fact that it is commonly held to be so by the majority of others. An example of this is how we call the bright orb in the night sky a moon. There's no logical underpinning for calling the moon, moon. Or, I mean, that's the English word, but in other languages we have other terms. So there's really nothing from the side of that object, you know, as to why we should call it the moon. Nothing, there's no moonness from the side of the object. So we only call it that through the power of naming and conceptuality, because that is what everybody else calls it. Because it is widely known as moon, we realize that the object is suitable to be referred to as such. There's no special reason for why the moon is called a moon. It is just a sound that has been designated to that object and has come into common use and generally entails things like the names we give to persons and things. For example, calling a particular child John has no logical basis. It's simply the conventional designation we have for him that was initially given by his parents. So anything that we ascertain in this way through the power of worldly nominal convention is arrived at by way of inferences through what is conventionally renowned. So it helps a little bit. I'm still not clear though on the practical use of this, like when and how would we use this kind of inference? But I'm just guessing, because this whole explanation is based on the ancient texts of Dignaga and Dharmakirti, and apparently in those texts they spend a lot of time using logic to refute non-Buddhist views. There are lots of, like in India, many, many different philosophers and scholars, and they all have their different views about things. And so Dignaga and Dharmakirti, I think, were often pointing out the faults in these other views of these other scholars. So my guess is that maybe this has to do with that. Maybe there was some other group that had a particular view of things that was incorrect, and this kind of logic was to refute them. But that's just a guess. I don't know for sure, but maybe that's where it came from.
Back since last week and read John Boucher's beginning of his thesis that Jeffrey gave us when we studied Vaibhashika, and he introduced it with this whole thing about language and these non-Buddhist traditions and the Vedas and all that. And I think it might be a pushback against that too, because it was like some of these non-Buddhist groups who they had to assert that the Vedas were true, but in their belief system they had things like that the world was created by the sound Om. And so, and then that the objects and their names actually weren't just designated, they were that name. And that, and it actually turns out that at the time of the Buddha, or at least at the time of Dignaga, even by 500 BC, they had kind of lost the connection between the language and the meaning of the words. So there was this whole, that's why the whole thing about grammar became so important, because they went back and looked at the etymology of the words to try to figure out the meaning. And there was all this stuff that words had all this power, but you had to have the words exactly correct. So there was just so much, there was so much going on. And he actually did say in that, in his book, that that grammar was the physics of the time. And in the sense of the that words were objects in some of these people's view, and they had a great amount of power, what we would call now maybe magical power, but it's the view they had. Mm-hmm. And so, let's see, there were just so, it's just, there's different points and this and that, but Dignaga clearly said that words are just things we designate. And the Buddhists, mm-hmm. there, so the Buddhist view about language and words was different from the some, not all, but some of the non-Buddhists. Some agreed with the, there was a group that agreed with the Buddhists, and there were others that didn't have their own views. So there was a lot going on around language and words.
Mm. Yeah. And he also says in these, in this book, that the most important of these three types of inferential cognizers is inferences through the power of the fact. So I think, you know, we don't have to worry too much about this one. Bang our heads against the wall trying to figure it out and how do we use it and so on. So, yeah, that's my take on it. You can go into it more if you want to. So then the third of the three types of inference is called inference through belief. And this is used to realize very hidden phenomena. An example of which is the subtle, very subtle workings of karma, cause and effect, which can only be known by a Buddha. Okay, so karma has different levels, and the more coarse, gross levels of karma we can understand. We don't need to rely on Buddha. But the subtle workings of karma, for example, what is the specific cause that was created millions of lifetimes ago for a particular effect that's happening in the present? Yeah, so that kind of thing is not something we can know through logic nor through direct perception. But it's said that a Buddha is able to know that. The mind of a Buddha is able to see everything. So a Buddha can know what was the specific cause for that result. So, to be able to realize these very subtle workings of karma, we need to rely on a Buddha, someone who's reliable. So an example of this, of a syllogism of this kind of inference is, if you have your notes, if you have one, this is the end of part two of the notes that I sent out last week. It says, the subject, the scripture, through giving resources, through ethics, happy migrations, is preceded by a valid cognition that realizes the meaning that is its object of indication because of being a scripture that is devoid of the three contradictions. So, that's a lot of words there. In simple language, so this is talking, the subject of this syllogism is a scripture, this, words of the Buddha, which say, if you give, you will get resources. If you practice ethics, you will get good rebirths. Okay, so this is something that was stated by the Buddha. Okay, so that kind of statement, it's the predicate of this syllogism is, it was preceded by a valid cognition that realizes the meaning that is its object of indication. What that means is what we're trying to prove here is that those words came from somebody's valid cognitions. Okay, they weren't just words that were came out of nowhere, but there was a valid cognition in somebody's mind. This is the Buddha's mind, actually, we're talking about. In the Buddha's mind, there was a valid cognition knowing the truth of these words, knowing that by giving we get resources, by ethics we get happy migrations. Okay. So in the Buddha's mind, there was this valid cognition knowing this, having absolute certainty about this. And the sign, the reason here is because this is a scripture devoid of the three contradictions. So the three contradictions, this gets rather complicated, but the first of the three contradictions, or being devoid of the three contradictions, is if this scripture says anything about manifest phenomena, meaning things that we can directly perceive, so if there's any discussion of manifest phenomena in this scripture, it shouldn't be contradicted by direct perception. Okay? So if there's something in this scripture that can be contradicted by direct perception, then that's a contradiction. I was thinking of an example of this. His Holiness often talks about the description of Mount Meru in like Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, Treasury of Knowledge. You know, it describes the size, the shape, the materials, the location of Mount Meru. And His Holiness says, well, if there really did exist this mountain, we should be able to see it, because it's huge and it's said to be in the middle of the universe. And so, you know, people have explored this whole planet on the ground and from the air and in the sea, and there's not much, I don't think there's many places in this world that haven't been explored and photographed and filmed and so forth. So if there really did exist this mountain, how come nobody has found it and photographed it, right? So he says, it should be perceivable with our direct perception, and yet nobody does perceive it. Nobody does have a direct perception of it. Therefore, it's contradicted. This description of Mount Meru is contradicted by direct perception. Therefore, we don't have to believe in it. So I think that could be an example of this first kind of contradiction. So if there's something that we can contradict with direct perception, then that means it's a contradiction. And the second is, if in this scripture there's any discussion about slightly hidden phenomena, then what it says about slightly hidden phenomena shouldn't be damaged by inference through the power of fact, that first type of inference. So that's the type of inference that is able to realize slightly hidden phenomena. So if there is a slightly hidden phenomena mentioned in that text, we should be able to affirm it, confirm it with that kind of inference. And if we can't, or if it's contradicted by that kind of inference, then that again is a contradiction. Does that make sense? A little bit. Third is, if the scripture talks about very hidden phenomena. So again, very hidden phenomena are things we cannot know with our direct perception. Also, we cannot know them by logic, by inference through the power of the fact. But very hidden phenomena, if there's contradictions, actually another text talks about this, if there's inner contradictions, like if what it said earlier is contradicted by something that it says later, okay, or if explicit meanings are contradicted by implicit meanings or something like that, so inner contradictions within the text itself, then that would be again a contradiction. So if we are unable to find any contradictions in this scripture, any of these three types of contradictions in the scripture, then that means it is free of these three kinds of contradictions. So basically what this means is we don't just blindly believe everything that's said in the scriptures, but we investigate, we check, and this is one way of checking if the scriptures are free of these three contradictions. So I don't fully understand this whole thing, but that's just a brief explanation of what it means. And I was thinking about, like in our daily life, in our normal life, for example, if there's something happening in another part of the world, in Syria or Iraq or India, so we cannot see that with direct perception. It's not accessible to our direct perception from where we are now. So we can't know in that way. And we also can't know it logically. Okay, we can't figure out what's going on by using logic. So in a way, that's like a very hidden phenomena, right? Some event taking place on the other side of the world is a very hidden phenomena. So what we usually do is we rely on the news, different sources of news, CNN, New York Times, BBC, whatever, okay? So do you think that's this type of inference through belief? If we hear something on the news and then we think, oh yeah, today there was this terrorist attack in, I shouldn't say that. I hope there wasn't a terrorist attack anyway. Something happened. Okay, let's just say something happened in Delhi today, okay? We heard it on the news. And then we think, okay, that happened. Is that an inference, do you think? Inference through belief?
This one also have the criteria that it has to be from a very reliable source.
Yeah, yeah. So are these really reliable sources?
I don't know.
News? Especially all the false news these days. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one point. Is this, really 100% reliable? Because ordinary people, I mean, even if it's a person who is trying to be honest and genuine and telling the truth, they still have their delusions in their mind that could cause distorted perceptions of what they are seeing or hearing and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, what we say about the Buddha is Buddha's mind is completely free of any faults. So everything the Buddha knows is correct and accurate and 100% reliable. But ordinary beings' minds are just full of all kinds of mistaken conceptions and distortions and so forth. So that's one thing. I think my thought is that, you know, knowing about things that happen via the news is probably correct assumption. We haven't gotten to that one yet. That's coming a bit later, but correct assumption rather than inference. But I think we do have inferences. Like I mentioned a few kind of simple examples. When you see, you know, footprints in the snow or in the mud, you can know that a certain type of being, animal or human, walked there sometime recently. Or if you see, you know, smoke coming out of the chimney, you know there's a fire in the fireplace, in the stove in that place, and so on. So just in our daily life, we do have correct inferences about things which we cannot directly perceive. They're not accessible to our five senses, but we can know them through some kind of sign or mark or reason proving the existence of that phenomenon. Anyone else think of any examples of these that happen in our life, in our daily life?
I think we may do this in the community kind of a lot. If we know that someone has a habit, for example, of putting all the bananas on a counter, and so we come and we see the bananas on the counter, and we say, "Oh, Venerable XX was here,"
mm-hmm.
But we don't know that.
Yeah.
Someone else easily could have put the bananas on the counter, but we will report, oh, XX was here because the bananas are here.
Yeah. So that may not have the pervasion,
right.
The full pervasion. If the bananas are on the counter, then necessarily so-and-so put them there. It's probably not a privation.
I don't know if this one counts, but usually in many countries when a flag is at half-mast, then we infer that someone has passed away.
Somebody important.
Yes. But yesterday we were at the Gonzaga campus, and their huge flag was at half-mast. Mm. We just thought maybe we missed something, hoping that... So then we asked some students, they had no clue. So maybe just someone forgot to put the flag back up.
Maybe there's something wrong with the mechanism and it fell down. I was thinking about the gas tank, you know, when in the car. We can't see the gas tank,
right,
and we can't know what's going on in the gas tank, logically. But on the car, we have this, what do you call it, the gauge? Gas gauge, okay? So if that is going down towards E, then is that a correct sign that the gas tank is empty or almost empty? I mean, it could be broken, of course. It could be broken. But usually, it's a sign that...
Is that inference through fact?
That would be not inference through the power of the fact. Yeah, yeah.
There's no
it's not a pervasion. It's not a pervasion, though, because it could be broken.
I've driven a lot of cars
for I'm going to talk my head.
If we know someone's reliable, then anything they would have told us that we haven't seen, like, you know, because they use the example of when we were born, our mother is the... is inferenced by the power through belief, because our mother can tell us when we were born. So couldn't it just be other things that they are reliable for? But why would you have an inference about something like that?
I don't think that is an inference. I think that's a correct assumption. Because people do make mistakes and they do tell lies. So, I mean, there's no pervasion that if your mother tells you you were born on such and such date, that it's absolutely true and no doubt about it.
So
I don't think there's a pervasion.
It has to
there.
Be as tight as like smoke as fire.
Yeah. When you see smoke, there has to be fire, because smoke doesn't exist without fire.
Someone online is asking that if there is one contradiction in a scripture, for example, Mount Meru in the Treasury of Knowledge, does that mean that particular scripture is not reliable in total?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Because scripture, it depends on what you mean by scripture. If you mean by scripture an entire book, then that's one thing. But I actually came across this in Jeffrey's book, Meditation on Emptiness. A sutra isn't necessarily an entire book. It could be just one phrase or one sentence. So I think it's probably more like that.
So it'd be unreliable for that particular topic
that
within
that
text.
Yeah, that particular statement, but it doesn't mean everything else in that text is wrong because that one thing is wrong. That wouldn't make sense.
And maybe inference through renown would be someone, if you're learning a language and someone's telling you this is what these words mean in this language, that would be...
Maybe, could be. Sounds good. You'd have to ask Dharmakirti and Dignaga what they mean by this. But yeah, it does seem to mean it's the way in which we understand that, you know, an object can be called by any name. I think it has to be. I don't know how many people would agree on a particular term being used. I don't think it has to be the entire world agrees on that, but at least a group of people, like for example, the people in this community agreeing upon that cat being called Upeka, and another one Maitri, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it doesn't mean everyone in the world has to know about that or agree on that, but at least within a certain community.
So when it's summer in the northern hemisphere, we infer that it is winter in the southern hemisphere. So is that inferenced by the power of fact?
I don't know if that's an inference. But Because there would have to be a sign, a correct sign or reason to infer that. So what would be the reason? Yeah, I mean, it's got to do with the whole, I don't know, what do you call it? The way that the planet moves and its relation to the sun and its orbit and so on and so forth, that it's winter in one place and summer in another. So yeah, I mean, yeah, that is the power of the fact. It is a natural phenomenon. It's not something human beings created or invented. It's the nature of things.
Leads a little bit into, what about environmental damage? You know, some people believe in climate change, other not.
Some people deny it. Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked into all the details of that, but it seems that there's been a huge amount of research, scientific, you know, findings. But whether they prove absolutely 100% that human behavior is responsible for these changes in the environment, I don't feel I'm capable of saying that. You know, it's more like there's this information and it's pointing to that. But is that an absolute foolproof fact? I don't know.
In this class, I remember Venerable Children, and we talked about once that a scientist wouldn't say that they prove anything, because that wouldn't be the proper language. They have, like, probabilities. And then, but math can prove things that are, have like a closed loop. Maybe even logical systems can prove things, but science in general, they only have probabilities. Mm-hmm. Not proofs. We use that word, science proved this, but it's not actually.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of what they say in like this classic example of where there's smoke, there's fire. If you see smoke, that is a definite correct sign proving the existence of fire, because smoke is the result of fire. But you can't do it the other way around. You cannot say that if there's fire, there will necessarily be smoke, because not all fires make smoke. So they say you can't use the cause to prove the result. You can use the result to prove the cause, but you can't use the cause to prove the result. You can say there might be a result, or there's a suitability of a result arising, but it's not absolutely definite, because things could interfere. Things could happen that would change that. So maybe it's a bit like that. Just because the causes are there, it's not 100% sure that the result will arise. But if the result is already there, you know the cause had to be there. If you see these, like now there's all these daffodils, I'm sure they're going to come up in the next couple of days. Open up. Okay, so we see the results, these, you know, stems and leaves and the flowers starting to rise. So we know there must have been daffodil bulbs under the ground. Okay, but just because you have daffodil bulbs under the ground, it's not definite the daffodils, because animals could come and eat them, or we could have a frost and they would be whatever. So things could interrupt the arisal of results. But if the result is already there, the cause is definitely present, or at least it was there previously. So I think we'll probably have to move on, because we still have five more of these minds to cover. Okay, so I sent part three of these notes, and so now we'll look at the third of the seven types of awareness, which is called subsequent cognizers. Okay, so the definition of this, or one definition of this, is a knower which realizes that which has already been realized. So it's a mind that realizes, it's like a re-realization, something that was previously realized by a valid or prime cognizer. So this is a mind that follows a prime cognizer and it realizes again that same object. So that's the definition. Now we'll look at explanation of it. So it says, a subsequent cognizer realizes an object that was previously realized by a prime or valid or reliable cognizer. It could arise immediately, like the next moment after this prime cognizer, or it could be sometime later. And they always realize their objects. And so subsequent cognizers are always incontrovertible. This word incontrovertible, it's not really something we normally use, is it? Some translators use infallible. That might be an easier term. Basically what it means is when a mind knows its object in a completely correct, certain, definite way, so it's able to later remember, I saw that object, I experienced that object. That's the meaning of realizing. Okay, so this type of mind does realize its object. And so, therefore, wrong consciousnesses and inattentive perceptions are never subsequent cognizers. We haven't gotten to those yet, so you can kind of ignore that sentence for now. We'll get to those later. Okay, the next paragraph says, although they realize their objects and are incontrovertible, they are not valid cognizers. They are not prime cognizers or reliable cognizers. The reason for this is because they're not new. The definition of a valid or prime cognizer is a new and incontrovertible knower. So it has to be new. Why is that important? So it said that the first moment of a consciousness engages its object by its own power, and that's why it's considered to be new and therefore valid. Subsequent moments, like following moments in that continuum, in that sequence, they don't realize the object by their own power, but by the power of the first moment. So they use this analogy of a train, where you have the first car, the engine, and that moves by its own power, but the other cars don't move by their own power. They move by the power of the engine. They're pulled along by the engine. Okay, so if we have an experience of looking at an object like a daffodil, so the first moment of seeing that object does so, gets at its object by its own power, and then the following moments, 2, 3, 5, 7, however many moments, they're just sort of pulled along by that first moment. So they're not getting at the object by their own power, but by the power of the first moment. So it says, for example, the first moment of an eye consciousness seeing the moon realizes its object through the force of experience. The later moments no longer rely on experience, but are induced by the force of the first moment. So that's why subsequent cognizers are not considered valid or reliable. But that doesn't mean they're wrong. They're still incontrovertible. They still realize their objects. They're incontrovertible. But they just lack the newness of the first moment. And there's also something else. The next paragraph says, furthermore, the first moment of realizing an object, which is a prime cognizer, removes superimpositions. So this word superimpositions, it means things that aren't true, things that are false. For example, when we have afflictive emotions, like we're angry at somebody, we see all these negative things about the person. And a lot of that is projected by our own mind. We project things on that person, make them much worse than they really are. So those are superimpositions. And the opposite happens when we have a strong attachment to a person or an object. We put a lot of positive superimpositions. Oh, they're so wonderful, they're so fantastic, and sort of exaggerate out of proportion. So those are examples of superimpositions, false modes of existence. So it said that of a reliable cognizer, a prime cognizer, a valid cognizer, removes superimpositions from the object so that it's able to see it correctly. And here's a couple of more examples of superimpositions. For example, thinking that a blue object is green, or thinking that sound is permanent rather than impermanent. So those are other examples of superimpositions. So subsequent cognizers don't remove superimpositions. It's only that first moment, the prime or valid or reliable cognizer, that removes superimpositions. And the subsequent cognizer just kind of goes along with that. So that's just another reason why they're not considered valid or reliable cognizers. Okay, then there are two types of subsequent cognizers. So subsequent cognizers can be conceptual or non-conceptual. So first we look at the non-conceptual ones. Direct perceivers. So for example, the first moment of an eye consciousness, correctly seeing the moon, is a prime or valid direct perceiver. Later moments in that same continuum of eye consciousnesses seeing the moon are subsequent cognizers. Okay, so they're direct perceivers and they're subsequent cognizers. And this is true for all four types of direct perceivers. So can someone give me an example of a subsequent cognizer which is a mental direct perceiver?
Second moment of me reading your mind.
Don't do that. But yeah, that's true. If you have clairvoyance or anybody has clairvoyance and they're able to read the mind of another person, that is a mental direct perceiver. So the first moment of that would be a, you know, a prime cognizer, a valid cognizer. Second, third, fourth moment and so on would be subsequent cognizers. And what about self-knowing direct perceiver? What would be a subsequent cognizer in that, of that type?
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking, is it possible? Because you have the second moment of a, if a self-knower arises in the same moment of the consciousness that it is observing, is there a second moment? I mean, it's always going to be prime, right?
I think, yeah, I think, like, if you have the eye consciousness seeing the moon, the first moment is a prime cognizer. So the self-knower of that would also be a prime cognizer. Yeah? And then the second moment of the eye consciousness, which is a subsequent cognizer, the self-knower of that would be a subsequent cognizer. I think it's like that. Yeah. It's no longer new.
But it is new, and it's the first moment of the self-knower that's cognizing a subsequent cognizer.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, I'd have to look it up in here. It's been a while since I read this. An example of a self-knowing subsequent cognizer is the second moment of a self-knower which is experiencing a sense direct perceiver apprehending a form. So he doesn't specifically say if this sense direct perceiver is a valid cognizer or not. It's interesting. Yeah. Let me see if I can find any more information about that, but it's a bit of an obscure point. Because anyway, the higher schools don't even believe in self-knowers, so we don't have to worry about self-knowers. Okay, how about yogic? A yogic direct perceiver, what would be a subsequent? Want to make a guess? Where's that mic?
The subject, the second moment of a yogic direct perceiver realizing subtle impermanence.
Right. So the first moment of having a direct realization of subtle impermanence would be a prime cognizer, a valid cognizer. But the second moment, third, fourth, and so on would be subsequent. So they're still totally correct and incontrovertible. They realize their object, but they just don't have the newness of the first moment. Okay, so then the second type are conceptual subsequent cognizers, and these in turn are of two types. The first one, a conceptual subsequent cognizer induced by direct perception. For example, after having a series of correct eye consciousnesses seeing the moon, one can have a conceptual subsequent cognizer thinking about the moon. Okay, so maybe for several moments you're just looking at the moon without thinking anything, and then thoughts start coming. Oh, what a beautiful moon. Oh, this is like the moon I saw in Hawaii last year when I was on vacation, and blah, 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 all these kind of thoughts about the moon. So those would be conceptual subsequent cognizers that are induced by a direct perception. They come about through the force of a direct perception. So we have lots of these. Whenever we're thinking about past experiences, things that we saw, things we heard, food that we ate, smells, bodily sensations. So, you know, with any of our five senses, if we think later about those experiences, then these would be that type of mind. Especially when you're meditating, right? All these kind of things come up. Wanting to re-experience those wonderful things. And the second one, B, is a conceptual subsequent cognizer induced by an inference. So, for example, the first moment of an inference realizing the impermanence of our body, independence on a correct sign, that would be an inferential valid cognizer. Later moments of that experience, continuing to, you know, think about, meditate on the impermanence of our body, those would be conceptual subsequent cognizers induced by that inference. And in the book here, Mind in Tibetan Buddhism, Lhati Rinpoche says, there's discussion about, okay, let's say you're meditating and you realize for the very first time subtle impermanence, inferentially. So you have this inferential realization, my body is impermanent, it's changing every moment. So that first moment of that realization is a prime cognizer, a valid cognizer, it's an inferential cognizer. The second moment and so on, if you're continuing to sit there and meditate, those would be subsequent cognizers. But then what happens if you get up from your meditation, go and do other things, and then later you come, again, sit down and meditate on the impermanence of your body? Do you again have a prime cognizer realizing that? Or are they just subsequent cognizers? So he says there's different opinions. Some say that the first moment is always a prime cognizer, but he thinks no. He thinks they're all subsequent cognizers. But I guess, yeah, there's different opinions about that. And in fact, he says that right up to the point where you have the direct realization, like the yogic direct perceiver realizing subtle impermanence, then again you have a prime cognizer. That would be the direct perceiver, not an inferential one. But he says, between the time of having your first inferential cognizer and that moment of having the direct prime cognizer, they're all subsequent cognizers. That's his opinion, but there's discussion about it. I think it's because that first moment is so powerful, you know, when you really get it, finally, this object is impermanent.
But don't you have to, every time you sit up to a point anyway, don't you have to induce the realization again through an inference? Until
yeah, but it's more like a memory. I think what he's saying, it's more like remembering that realization, recalling that realization. But he does say there's different opinions about that. So some do say that each time it is a valid cognizer. Yeah, he says, there's much debate as to whether if one gets up from one's meditation session and sometime later returns to meditation on the same topic, the first moment of, the first moment of direct perception is again a prime cognizer or is still a subsequent one. Some say it is prime because one is newly generating a continuum of direct perception. Others say it is not a prime cognizer because it is engaging its object due to the force of the former direct perception. But this is talking about direct perception. So I think he was saying previously with inference, there's only that first one single inferential valid cognizer, and all the rest are subsequent up until you have the direct realization. But I don't think the same. I remember discussing this previously with just our ordinary everyday direct perceptions. You know, when you look at a Upekkha, for example, you look at him at one point in time, you have the first moment as a direct prime cognizer, you look away, you look again. I think it's in that case, it is still, the first moment is still a direct, a prime cognizer. I think that's what we learned before. But anyway, yeah, there's probably different opinions about this. Okay, then next point. It says, in each of these examples given above, the subsequent cognizers realize the same object as the first moment, and the strength of the initial realization has not been lost. However, the realization has not been gained by their own power. Rather, they merely realize something that has already been realized by the first moment. Also, they do not remove superimpositions. For example, that, you know, what you're seeing is the moon and not a street light. Have you ever been in that situation when you're in a city and there's all these street lights and the moon is in the sky as well, and you're kind of trying to figure out which one is a street light and which one is the moon? Anyway, that would be one example of a superimposition. So it's the initial moment, the prime cognizer, that removes superimpositions and enable you to have that realization, correct realization of what the object is. Okay, then there's just a little bit of information here about the importance of inferential cognizers and subsequent cognizers in Dharma practice. So in Dharma practice, we need to transform our mind by overcoming mistaken conceptions and disturbing emotions, and cultivating correct and positive states of mind. We need inferential cognizers to understand hidden objects such as impermanence and emptiness. So our mind is actually totally polluted by mistaken conceptions. Even though things are impermanent, we see them as permanent. Even though things are empty of inherent existence, we see them as inherently existing. Okay, so we have these mistaken conceptions in our mind, and we have to remove those to be able to see things correctly. So to be able to remove them, we first need to generate inferential cognizers, realizing impermanence, because impermanence isn't something we can just immediately directly realize with our senses, with our eyes and ears and so forth. We have to first realize it inferentially, then we can understand it directly. And the same with emptiness, selflessness, and so on. So we first need to generate inferential cognizers. And then we need to keep these in mind and not forget them. Right? So, you know, once we do have an understanding of our realization of impermanence, we want to be able to make our minds strongly, deeply familiar with that. And that involves subsequent cognizers. So we can do this during meditation itself. So after understanding something in meditation, staying with that understanding as long as possible, keeping our mind focused on it as long as possible. And that means we're cultivating subsequent cognizers regarding that topic. And this is true with all the Lamrim topics. I'm not sure, I was thinking about this, but I didn't get too far in my thinking. For example, precious human rebirth, or the sufferings of samsara. What kind of mind do we have when we meditate on those? I'm not sure if that would be inference, probably more like correct assumption. But even a correct assumption, we're going to get to that soon, that's still very good. At least we're going in the right direction. It's not as powerful as an inference, but it's definitely taking us in the right direction. So we cultivate these understandings, and then we need to keep them in mind and not forget them as much as we can, both during meditation, but also after meditation in our daily life. So we try to remember, like, you know, I have this precious human life, this precious human rebirth. I don't want to waste it. I don't want to use it to do harmful things, create negative karma and so on. I want to use it to create virtue and benefit others and create the cause for enlightenment and so on. So we meditate on that in meditation. We get some understanding of that, some certainty about that, and then we need to keep that going as much as possible in our life. So again, this is subsequent cognizers. We're cultivating subsequent cognizers. So they're very useful. Very, very useful. And also, using the language of science, we're building new neural pathways. And so this is how our mind gets transformed. Because, for example, if we see things as impermanent, that'll help us to deal with disturbing emotions like attachment, anger, fear, anxiety, jealousy, pride, and so on. So this is just a little bit about how the usefulness, you know, it's not just technical information, but it is very useful in our life and in our Dharma practice.
So when I eat something and I have an aversion towards it, that's based on a subsequent cognizer, not a direct.
When you eat something?
Yeah, and I have an aversion, you know, I, like in Taiwan, I had things to eat and I had no choice that evoked in me some physical aversion that I wanted to throw up. Uh-huh. So, yeah. And I had no experience with that food before. It was totally new. Uh-huh. But still, I have heard before some years ago that those experiences are subsequent cognizers. We had some, it's based on some mental conceptions.
Some what conception?
Mental.
Mental conception. I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I would have thought.
That's because
you were
ordained in California.
No. But once upon a time, I was in Malaysia. I was in a monastery in Malaysia, and I was invited to lunch with the abbot. I was sitting next to the abbot at lunch, and there was this plate of what I thought was dumplings. They were these kind of white things, and I took a piece and put it in my mouth. It was durian. You know what durian is? Well, sitting next to the abbot, I had to be polite, so I finished eating it. But so I know what you're talking about. I have this experience too.
That's a direct perception.
That is. That's a direct respiratory perception.
Smell, everything. And I don't know. I mean, some people love it, right? Some people are crazy about it. So why do some people love it? Some people hate it. Karma. And similar with coffee, you know, some people love coffee. Some people, ugh, how can you drink this stuff?
It's a fruit?
Sorry? Yeah. Durian is a fruit, yeah.
So they say. Yeah.
Very unusual food. yeah, I don't know if that's karma, karmic imprints. How could it be a subsequent cognizer? Because if you've never experienced it before, it's the very first time you've ever experienced it, and you have this immediate dislike. I don't know, it could be karma, but it could also be familiarity in this lifetime. I mean, people who grow up in a country where durian is there and their parents eat it, and you know, they might like it. Same with Vegemite and Marmite, you know? I mean, sorry. You know, if you grew up in Australia, you love Vegemite. But, you know, if you're introduced to that when you're 20 years old or something, you've never eaten it before, you might think, ew, this is terrible. So a lot of it is familiarity, things that we're familiar with, things that we grow up with and in our culture and so on. I don't know. But we can overcome those things. I mean, I like Vegemite. We're not doing it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so too, that you might have the right direction. Once Venerable Shoten was giving a feedback to one of us, this person had a dislike, an immediate dislike towards another person who came here for a visit, and she said it went on for some weeks. And so in the end, this person who was living here could not explain it to himself. And then Venerable Shoten said it's most likely karma. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something similar to a reaction to food or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But these things can be changed. I mean, if we work on it, look at why we feel this way and use reasoning, you know, like if I was starving, I could probably eat durian quite happily. you know, durian, you have it in Vietnam? Yeah. So, and also with people, we may feel an aversion towards. We can look at that, work on that, and then find reasons why we can like this person and overcome the aversion. And they use this in psychology, isn't it? For example, people who have what do they call them? Phobias. Mm-hmm. They can work with them and try to get them more familiar with that thing that they're afraid of and gradually overcome it. Okay, should we move on? The fourth one, correctly assuming consciousnesses, or sometimes they're called correct assumption, an easier term. Okay, the definition, a factually concordant. Sorry. A mouthful of words. A factually concordant determinative knower that is controvertible with regard to determining its object. Isn't that clear? Okay, so let's go through the words here. So factually concordant means that it's correct. It knows its object correctly as it is. And then determinative knower, we came across that term before, and that's just another way of saying a conception rather than a perception. So this mind is always conceptual. It's never perception. And then controvertible, it's not convertible. Controvertible is the opposite of incontrovertible. Okay, so this type of mind it's not infallible, it's fallible. It doesn't realize its object. It doesn't eliminate superimpositions about its object. And is therefore unable to lead to absolute certainty about it. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It's not as bad as that. It's not totally wrong. It just doesn't have this strength of being totally correct, totally realizing, totally getting at the object without any superimpositions. So next point, therefore there is a difference between being correct about an object and actually realizing an object. So we can be correct about something, but that doesn't mean we realize it necessarily. So most of what we know, even our birth date, are correct assumptions, correctly assuming consciousnesses. So actually it was Geshe Ma Kelsang Wangma who gave that example of our birth date. That's a correct assumption. Because if you think about it, I mean, we were there. We were experiencing things, but we were not able to know what day it was, right? We didn't have that ability to know it's June the 4th, 19, whatever. 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so our mind was not able to know that. So we weren't able to have a direct perception of our birth date. And it's also not something we can know by logic. We can't figure it out logically. There's no logic to figure out our birthday. So we have to rely on other people, like our mother, our parents. And probably most parents tell the truth. I mean, they might have some reason to not tell the truth, but, you know. But also, I mean, there are places in the world where, you know, the mother is just working out in the field and the baby comes out and she doesn't necessarily know what day it is. Maybe they don't have calendars and that kind of thing. So maybe they just come up with some approximation of the birth date, but it may not be the exact date and time that, according to Western calendar. And also, like, many people are born in hospitals, and hospitals are very keep records, very, you know, detailed records of births and so forth. So we rely on other people, like our parents or, you know, whoever filled out the birth certificate in the hospital to know what our birth date is. So this is correct assumption. We don't know it with absolute 100% certainty. We are assuming it to be true. And this is true for most of our knowledge. You know, everything we've ever learned at school, from the news, reading books, and talking to people, most of it is correct assumption rather than inference, valid inferential cognizers. So even, you know, impermanence and emptiness, we don't have actual realizations of these objects. We're assuming them to be true, and we're correctly assuming them to be true. Okay, so the next point says an inferential cognizer is both correct about and realizes its object. And this is because it arises in dependence on a correct sign or reason. You go through a process of logic, and you use this sign, and then you realize something in dependence on that sign. And then in contrast to that, a correctly assuming consciousness is correct about its object. It's got the correct information, but it doesn't realize it. And this is because of the way it is generated. Okay, so according to Purbujok, so Purbujok is the author of another text on Lohrig, not this one. There are five types of correctly assuming consciousness, depending on the ways in which they are generated. So how do they come about? How do we get a correctly assuming consciousness? So the first one is without any reason. An example of this would be thinking that sound is impermanent just because you heard it from a teacher, but it's not based on any reason as to why sound is impermanent. So probably a lot of our Dharma knowledge is like that. We go to teachings, or we read books, we listen to YouTube talks, you know, we get all this information and we go along with it. Yeah, that's true. Sound, things are impermanent. I have a precious human rebirth. Buddha is omniscient, and so on and so forth. So we probably don't have a reason why, except that the Buddha said so, our teacher said so, the Dharma books say so. And again, this could also apply to much of our other knowledge, our secular knowledge and news and so forth, because somebody said so, we believe it. As long as it's correct, it has to be correct. If somebody says something that's wrong and we believe it, that wouldn't be a correct assumption. If somebody says, your body is permanent, and we think, okay, yeah, I'll go along with that. So that's not a correct assumption because it's not correct. Okay, correct assumption is only when we assume something to be true, which is true. Okay, the second one is with a contradictory reason. So there's this whole topic called signs and reasons, tarik in Tibetan, and it goes through all the different kinds of correct signs. There's lots of them. And it also talks about incorrect signs, or they're called pseudo signs or facsimiles of signs or quasi signs, these different terms. But these are signs or reasons which are actually incorrect. And there's three types of those. One is a contradictory reason. So an example of that is thinking sound is impermanent because it does not perform a function. Is that correct? So you probably know that impermanent things and performing a function are mutually inclusive. Functioning things and impermanent things So those two things are mutually inclusive. Whatever is impermanent performs a function. Whatever performs a function is impermanent. So those two things pervade each other. So this is completely off. Sound does perform a function. And whatever performs a function is impermanent. Not anyway. So this is incorrect because it's contradictory. Performing a function is contradictory with impermanence. Oh, sorry, not performing a function is contradictory with impermanence, the opposite. And the third is an indefinite reason. So this is another kind of mistaken or false reason. An example is thinking sound is impermanent because it exists. Is that correct? I mean, it is correct because sound is impermanent and it does exist, but what's wrong with this? No pervasion. And just because something exists, does that mean it's impermanent? No, because there's permanent things that exist. So that reason doesn't work. It's not enough to realize sound is impermanent. No pervasion. And then the fourth one is a non-established reason. So this is another type of quasi or facsimile of reason. An example is sound is impermanent because it is an object of eye consciousness. What's wrong with that? Yeah. What's the technical term of that, for that?
Property
of the subject. The first of the three modes that are required for a correct sign. The sign, the reason, it has to be a property of the subject. So being an object of the eye consciousness is not a property of sound. It doesn't apply to sound. So people do sometimes use wrong reasons. I mean, here it's talking about sound being impermanent, but just in daily life, you know, people sometimes believe in things for the wrong reason. They might have a correct idea about things, but for the wrong reason. I don't know, I can't think of any example.
We thought when we built Chinrizi that because this foam is something that generally people use to stop sound from moving places would work in that building. But the reason wasn't really true because the foam isn't, it was too hard. It wasn't right, but people do use that. We thought the reasoning was that it would, it does stop sound. I don't know, maybe I'm not knowing how to say this.
Mm-hmm. You heard that it amplifies the sound.
Yeah. It does exactly.
Well, that's really contradictory.
Yeah. It's just too hard.
You didn't come up with a correct thing.
Yeah, it's a non-established reason. Because it's foam. Because it's foam, we thought it would stop sound. But not all foam stops sound.
So you thought the subject... Foam will be a suitable insulation in the building.
A suitable soundproofer.
Soundproofer because?
Because foam stops sound. Look at the earplugs you put in your ears.
Oh, I
like,
see.
For example.
Just because we have. I see.
For example, I put in earplugs every night and it stops sound. And they're made out of foam.
Okay, so you thought just like earplugs in our ears
that
stop sound, then in between the walls it would also stop sound.
But it turns out that not all foam will stop sound.
Oh, okay.
Too hard.
I don't know which kind of reason that is. Anyway, it's a wrong reason. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, No, because we're talking about correct assumptions. Correct assumption is when you do have a correct understanding of something, you're correct about something, but not for the right reason. So that wasn't a perfect example. I don't know, I can't think of anything offhand, but if anyone thinks of something.
Going to college is useful because you can earn a lot of money. But actually it's useful because it teaches you how to think properly or clearly. It can.
So is there a pervasion there? That if you go to college, you will earn a lot of money?
No.
No. In fact, you spend, you lose a lot of money.
Nor learn how to think correctly. That
also not necessarily, yeah. It depends on the college, right? Depends on...
And the student.
Yeah, and your professors.
So that's not a correctly assuming consciousness?
Well, going to college, I don't know, is it always useful? Is going to college
for the
always
most part
useful? I think it depends. Many different circumstances.
And what does going to college mean? My uncle, who was a playboy, went to college.
Your uncle what?
Who was a playboy, went to college.
Yes.
But there wasn't a whole lot of learning going on. But he sure met a lot of women.
Bread, when you bake bread, it always rises because it's made from flour.
It didn't rise?
No. It's made from flour.
Right. What I'm saying, but this is an example of bread will rise, but the wrong reason.
Because of flour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bread doesn't always rise.
Yeah, I was thinking the Dalai Lama is a nice person because he's a Tibetan.
Yeah.
The Dalai Lama is a nice person. He's a wonderful person. But is it because he's Tibetan? I mean, not every Tibetan is a nice person. There's no pervasion. Yeah. So that, I don't know, that might be an example of a correct assumption but wrong reason. Do you have one, Champa?
Likely, but many of you will grow up at home, may have something when parents admonish you or tell you something, then the parents just say, because I tell you.
Yes.
For example, I don't know, you may know better than I.
Because I say so. This is true because I say so. Anyway. The last one, number 5, with a correct reason which has not been brought to its full conclusion. So one might think, sound is impermanent because it is a product, but you have not gone through the whole process of reasoning, establishing the three modes in your mind. Right? So for that, for product is the reason in that case, for product to be a correct reason, it isn't a correct reason for just anybody. Like if you walk up to somebody in the street in Newport and you say, you know what, sound is impermanent because it's a product. Is that going to be a correct sign for that person?
We'll have destroyed all the trust.
So they say, it's only a correct sign for a specific person. The person has to be someone who has already realized that sound is a product. This is the first mode. Whatever is a product is impermanent, second mode, and the counter-pervasion, which is the opposite of that, but hasn't yet realized that sound is impermanent. So only that type of person, for that type of person, is product a correct sign. And you can do this with another person. You can throw that kind of syllogism to another person, but you also do it with yourself, like in meditation. You contemplate these points on your own and you come to realize, okay, sound is a product, whatever is a product is impermanent, therefore sound is impermanent. So when all those pieces have come together in your mind, you've actually realized those things in your mind, then it clicks. Ah, sound is impermanent. So in other words, the mind has to be developed to a certain point to be able to get this realization. So even if you have the right reason, but if your mind hasn't gotten to that point where it's ready to realize it, then it's mm-hmm. it's still correct assumption. But it's better than wrong, wrong thinking, thinking things are permanent. Okay, I thought maybe we could just finish this little section and then can stop. So in all of these examples, one has a correct understanding that sound is impermanent, but such understanding is weak, not strong. It could be overthrown upon meeting someone who gives seemingly strong arguments to the contrary. Somebody might come and, you know, give really good reasons as to why sound is permanent, and you might be swayed by that. Therefore, correctly assuming consciousnesses are not foolproof, reliable forms of knowledge. However, Lati Rinpoche, in this book, Mind in Tibetan Buddhism, he says that a correctly assuming consciousness is a knower which determines one-pointedly or decisively the phenomenon which is its main object of engagement. The meaning of one-pointedly is that this type of mind is free of the two-pointedness of doubt that thinks maybe it's this, maybe it's that. So later, number 6 of the 7 types of awareness is doubt. So we'll look at that. But there is a difference between doubt and correct assumption. Doubt is wavering. I don't know, maybe sound is impermanent, maybe it's not, I don't really know. So correct assumption is much more firm than that, even though it's not as strong as a full realization. But it's much more convinced and not easily swayed. But it seems like it could still be, you know, it still could be swayed and turned into doubt. So that's why we need to go beyond a correct assumption and have the inferential realization and then the direct realization, direct perception of things. But we're still heading in the right direction with correct assumption. So I'll stop there, and then next week, well, I think, because next week, my understanding is Venerable Chodron is going to give a talk in Spokane, a synagogue. Yeah, so I'll do class next week. So we'll see if we can get a few more of these done. 5, 6, 7, yeah, 3 more. Any last questions, Christina?
Have you ever seen any explanation for why there are subsequent cognizers and every cognizer is not a prime or a reliable cognizer?
Why are yeah. there?
And I think the Buddha, he only has prime cognizers, right?
Yeah, there's discussion about that in here, and it's quite complicated. When it comes to the Buddha's mind, yeah, they say, I think, if I remember correctly, every experience is a prime cognizer and a direct prime cognizer. No conceptions. But yeah, there's something about no subsequent cognizer. But
ignorance must induce the subsequent cognizer. Something's going on there.
No, I think, if I remember correctly, it's because each moment of the Buddha's mind moves by its own power and doesn't need to be induced by the power of another mind. Because that's one of the qualities of a prime cognizer. It engages its object from its own power, its own strength. So every moment of a Buddha's mind has that quality of, you know, getting at its object in a powerful way and not having to be pulled along by some other mind. Every moment is like an engine of a train and not like one of the cars. I think that's the reason. But for us, we're, well, there's a lot of reasons why our mind isn't like the Buddhist mind. Many reasons. Many things we have to clear away. And I think, yeah, I think it's simply because that's the way it is. Only certain minds engage an object through their own force, their own power, but others are pulled along. But why that is, I don't know. Why our minds are not like the Buddhist mind.